Welcome to the podcast series for AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology. I'm your host, Kara Hansel-Keehan. Today we'll discuss the article by Chatterjee et al. Titled, Mechanosignaling in the Vasculature, Emerging Concepts in Sensing, Transduction, and Physiological Responses. This article published online April 11th, 2015. My guests today are Associate Editor Nancy Kanagi, Lead Author Shampa Chatterjee, and content expert Mark Nelson. Let's get started.
Thank you, Kara. This meeting report is from a conference on mechanosignaling and the downstream redox-dependent responses. It highlights recent developments on the link between mechanical forces at the cell membrane and intracellular responses. The five individual reports all highlight different aspects of this rapidly developing area of research. The lead author and one of the presenters, Shampa Chatterjee, will discuss some of the key findings presented at this conference, which was held in August of 2014 at Aguaçu Falls, Brazil. An overarching theme in the reports is a prominent role for NADPH oxidase 2-derived superoxide in the signaling cascade downstream of mechanical perturbations. So first, Shampa, can you tell us what you feel to be the most novel finding that was presented at the conference?
What the speakers showed us was that there were a number of elements on the cytoskeleton that were probably acting together. For instance, there was PCAM, caveolin, VEGF receptor 2, and these formed multimeric complexes that my lab denotes by calling them mechanosomes. The second was that although there are different mechanosensors that sense various stimuli and different thresholds of these stimuli, most of the eventual response to mechanosensing occurs via redox signals. And that was clear from the presentations that we had. And then the third was that now our focus should be in trying to understand the machinery of mechanotransduction, which is a complex machinery rather than looking at individual elements that may participate in sensing.
Thank you for that succinct report. It sounds as if this really is a very changing field. Mark, did you have any comments on these reports or specific questions for Shampa?
Thank you. I guess I would like to get your feeling for how you put into perspective studies on cultured cells versus intact blood vessels versus the in vivo situation, and perhaps some of your strategy to link these different levels up into a coherent theme.
We are interested in mechanotransduction from the point of understanding what it does in terms of pathophysiology or physiology. What our lab does is that we use in vitro cells kept under flow for periods of 24 to 48 hours. We call this flow adapted, and then we use this to look at changes in flow. So that would be one way to address this.
You bring up an interesting point that many of the in vitro systems are cultured endothelial cells, sometimes cultured under flow conditions and sometimes not. Yet in vivo, you obviously have a syncytium of endothelial cells, smooth muscle cells, and other components. When you talk about these ex vivo systems, have you done any of your studies using organ culture of arteries under flow?
So we've looked at isolated lung preparations. These are lungs that are cleared and then placed on the stage of a microscope, and we try to image using fluorescent dyes production of ROS or calcium changes in these arteries. The advantage of the lung is that being filled with air, an isolated lung, is easier to visualize vessels, and that may not be possible in other organs. However, isolating of arterioles and cannulating them has been used by other groups, so that kind of studies are possible.
This brings up an interesting question of mechanotransduction. As you point out, the native endothelium has a glycocalyx, a thin layer of glycoproteins, and that the question is, what's being sensed? Is it really the glycocalyx that's being tugged on, then to affect PCAM? How do you visualize that in a in vivo situation where you have adaptation to flow as well as a glycocalyx in most situations?
I think there are two events that are happening. The first is that the cells are under flow for long periods, you know, like hours, months, years, and so on. So there is, under that condition, a kind of a a phenotype that is specific to underflow conditions. So there's that phenotype thing. So we don't really know in vivo how this interaction of the various elements is occurring. The second is the alteration of the stimuli. So for instance, they are always seeing flow. You can have one stimuli, which is a sudden cessation of flow. The other stimuli can be gradual increase in flow, like hypertension. So in each of these, how the various elements on the membrane via the glycocalyx, how they would interact is still not clear to us. And that's what I thought was one of the takeaway messages from this meeting, is that we ought not to focus on one sensor anymore. We now have to look at the machinery, because there are a number of elements that are interacting with each other.
One interesting parallel, I'm not sure, there was a recent study by John Lederer's group on stretch activation of NOX2 in cardiac myocytes, and that this was involved in a normal physiologic response in generating ROS to regulate calcium release. Have you considered your mechanism in the context of normal changes, either mechanical changes or shear stress, in a way sort of parallel to the Lederer X-ROS signaling system?
Yes. In our model of stop of shear, the first event is that there's some sensing and we see depolarization of the endothelial cells. This depolarization leads to activation of voltage-gated calcium channels. We couldn't measure the calcium channel activation per se, but we were able to see calcium influx into these cells and NO production, both in our endothelial cell work and other cardiac models.
Very interesting. I'm looking at your figure one. Maybe you could discuss briefly the evidence for voltage-dependent calcium channels in endothelial cells.
What we've seen in endothelial cells is that we were able to detect the message of this channel by RT-PCR, and keeping cells under flow increase this channel expression. Then these channels have been known to be activated at potentials ranging from minus 20 to minus 40. Resting endothelial cells are around at minus 70. They get depolarized and come to the range of minus 40 and 30. That's when this channel opens up and calcium goes in. We did not measure these currents by patch clamp, but we were able to see calcium influx, and that influx was blocked when we used specific voltage-gated calcium channel blockers.
Currents through these channels have not been measured. And are you referring to cultured endothelial cells as well, or native ones, freshly isolated ones?
Cultured endothelial cells.
In the report by Dr. Fujiwara, they looked at the role of PCAM1 in phosphorylation. And again, it was sort of something out of what we normally think of as PCAM, as not being so much a cell-cell contact signaling, but rather that it was being activated by a kinase in a role that was somewhat independent of these cell-cell contacts. Can you talk a little bit about this pathway, the PCAM1 phosphorylation, and how this was thought to be mediated?
Dr. Fujiwara's report showed that PCAM phosphorylation was key to downstream events, and this phosphorylation occurred via FIN kinase.
So making PCAM a very central player in the atherogenic response to disturbed flow.
Correct. It's not very clear to me where is the turning point between disturbed flow and stop of flow that PCAM senses differently.
You had the KATP knockout mice, is that right? And showed that
yes.
KATP knockout prevents revascularization. Does PCAM1 knockout similarly impair revascularization?
Yes, it does.
This is part of that then, what did you call it, the mechanosome?
Yes, we've coined a term, mechanosome, to explain this machinery, which I don't know what that machinery really is. I think we've just begun to understand parts of that machinery. So by no means what we have is a complete machinery.
Mark?
I'm looking at figure one, and I was trying to reconcile a depolarization with, I can see if there are calcium channels, you might have increase in calcium influx. There have been many studies that have shown that depolarization decreases calcium in the endothelium because there's just decreasing the calcium electrochemical gradient. But if it's increasing calcium and stimulating eNOS, as you've shown here, then it's also creating a depolarizing current, which I was wondering if you could comment would, in resistance arteries, maybe transmitted through gap junctions in myoendothelial projections to the adjacent smooth muscle. And a depolarization would tend to constrict the blood vessel, which would make the ischemia worse. So how do you visualize a sort of push-pull of either depolarization in the scheme 1 increasing NO, but at the same time that would be potentially transmitting a signal to the smooth muscle to constrict?
Most of the stuff that is shown in figure 1 is in vitro studies into a really large in vivo vessel scenario. And that was my main comment with, you know, this mechanotransduction field, is that there is a huge variation in the cells in culture, the source of the cells, the vascular beds, and there is also a huge variation in physiology, depending on the larger conduit arteries versus smaller arteries, arterioles, veins, and so on. So really, it would be difficult to comment on in a general way.
You bring up an interesting point, Shampa, that in the pulmonary circulation, where many of your studies have been done, in the pulmonary microvasculature is so much less muscularized than other vascular beds, that you get these small arteries, arterioles, that are essentially more capillary-like in that they're mostly endothelial tubes with very little smooth muscle. The question is, when you look at the endothelial cells that you take out of that setting and you compare them to the endothelials that you see in your femoral artery ligation model, have you done the molecular analysis to see, do they express the same components of this mechanosome, or is the mechanosome between these two very different beds have potentially different components in it?
What I want to say is the two beds are so vastly different in that the pulmonary cells in vitro show tube formation, but in vivo, when we use beads, we cannot get any new vessel formation. From the lab of Elizabeth Wagner several years ago, they had tried to do a left pulmonary artery ligation, and they found that the new vessels that were coming out were the intercostal vasculature that was proximal to the ischemic lung. So there is the lung endothelial cells do not really form new vessels for whatever reason.
I was wondering if I could get your idea on how you envision the red blood cells in a capillary interacting with your mechanosome, because this is in some ways much different than, as you mentioned, than a conduit or a larger artery where you'll have many endothelial cells wrapping around the lumen in the direction of blood flow. Here you have a red blood cell in the capillary, it's basically squeezing through and rapidly and, you know, touching the capillary endothelial cells as it goes through, because the diameter of a capillary is about that of a red blood cells. So it's a lot different microenvironment. So I guess my question is, this is sort of, you know, blue skying it. My question is, how do you envision that type of interactions in a capillary at the microscopic level where there are local oxygen gradients, different types of contacts versus a larger artery? And how would this fit into your scheme?
Gee, I have thought about this a lot and don't know what really goes on. So I could just sort of, I don't know, hand wave and say that although the RBCs do sort of squeeze in, that is a force that is being continuously sensed by the endothelium. And so those cells are adapted to that response in terms of, I think the squeezing is activating a mechanical pathway that maintains vessel homeostasis. That's all I can say. Whereas, you know, in the case of a blood clot or a larger impediment, that is something that these cells have not seen. And so then, you know, there is a response to it.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you, Shampa. This was a great discussion. And I think what it illustrates is that we still have a lot to learn about endothelial cells, where they're located, the forces they see, the channels they express are all still out there for us to continue to do work and to find more. But overall, what we have seen is that mechanotransduction in endothelial cells can be protective as well as potentially atherogenic, depending on the local stimulation. There are some new players that have been identified that transduce these mechanical stimuli into a cellular response. These include Fin kinase, PCAM1, NOX2, and these might represent potential targets for future investigations into processes that might promote or prevent vascular dysfunction. So for now, we will continue to move forward in this highly evolving field, and I thank you both and look forward to many great discoveries from both of your laboratories. Kara?
You've been listening to an AJP Heart and Circ podcast. For more podcasts, visit us online at ajpheart.physiology.org. Thank you.